Today, we'll be talking a radical approach to saving our planet. And I'm delighted to introduce our guests by telephone. So first, there is Lear Keith. Lear Keith is a writer, a small farmer, and a radical feminist activist. She is the author of two novels, as well as a work of nonfiction called The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. She's also a co-author with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay of Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. She's been arrested 6 times. Welcome to our show, Leary.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we're delighted you can be here, and we can do the whole hour on this program. And with you is a compatriot, Premadasi Amada. Premadasi is first-generation Latina. She's 40 years old. She hails from New York and moved to California 5 years ago. Premadasi is the main organizer for Deep Green Resistance. She's been an activist and revolutionary from the age of 16. Before the Deep Green Resistance, her most recent work was co-founding an organization in Palestine to support Palestinians against violent, racist Israeli settlers. Boy, welcome to our show, Premadasi.
Thank you for having me.
Well, delighted both of you can be on at the same time. Let me start with Lear. If you could just talk a bit about the book you wrote, The Vegetarian Myth. That shocked a lot of folks and gave you quite a bit of notoriety. Can you sort of sum up what your main contention is?
Yeah. I was a vegan for 20 years, and I believed that I was doing the best possible thing for animals, for the earth, and for my own health. And it turned out that on all three counts I was wrong. And, you know, I always want to be very clear that the underlying values of the vegetarian ethos, that's not the problem. So, you know, anything that questions human entitlement, human hubris, our longings for sustainability, for justice, those are the right values. And those are really the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. But that's not the problem. The problem is the ideology we build on top of that and then the practices that flow from that. And the real problem with the idea of, you know, vegetarianism is somehow saving the world is that it doesn't question where those vegetarian foods come from. And the brute fact is that agriculture is the most destructive thing people have done to the planet. And I didn't know that as, you know, when I was 16 years old and I became a vegan, I had no idea what agriculture was. I didn't know where my food came from. I would say most of us in the United States really have no idea what the impact of agriculture is. And this really goes back 10,000 years. I mean, this is something humans started doing 10,000 years ago, and it's just been a swath of destruction across the planet. So that was really hard information for me to come to grips with over my course of being a vegan. There were times when I grappled with it and times when I refused to look at it. And part of the problem with being a vegan is that it, for most of us, I think, it becomes our identity. And it makes it really hard to question. You know, when we get information that's bigger, you know, that's new, that somehow questions that, it's really hard to let that in. It feels very threatening. And so I grappled with that for on and off for 20 years. And in the end, you know, I had to face the fact that this was, you know, the single most destructive human activity and that it couldn't go on if we were going to save the planet. You know, and as a consequence, 99% of the grasslands of this planet have been destroyed for agriculture. And what that means is mass extinction. Those plants and animals have nowhere to go now. So, you know, in a nutshell, that was pretty much what the book is saying. I'm asking people to take their deepest values and to keep asking those questions, you know, to push past the kinds of attachments they may have to this diet or this identity and really look at what the cost is to the planet, the process of agriculture.
I like the way you're willing to, you know, take on this cultural meme and challenge it. And I want to say that it's probably true that many of us have our identity wrapped up in so many ways in this system that is unsustainable, and that's why there's so much denial. Is it's really hard for us to confront a system that we've become a part of. Is that generalizing too much from your vegan experience?
No, I would say that's very accurate, and it's one of the reasons I think it's going to be very hard to get to the kind of resistance movement that we need in the United States and in the wealthy nations. It's not just that we identify with the system, it's we benefit from it. I mean, this, you know, this last generation or two, it was a one-time blowout of fossil fuel, and we were the people who get all the cheap, easy living from it. And we are going to it's going to run out whether we like it or not, but it would be better if we could make it stop sooner rather than later, because more of the planet will be left. And that's part of what we're up against in, you know, trying to get this resistance movement going, is that people don't give up their entitlement easily.
Prima Dasi, are you back with us on the line?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. I wanted to ask, you mentioned that since the age of 16, you've been an activist and a revolutionary. You want to tell us a little bit about what got you to be thinking of yourself as a revolutionary?
Well, I was very lucky. My parents, my family is from Ecuador, and my parents decided to take me to Ecuador because I refused to speak Spanish, because this country is so racist, and they wanted me to connect with my roots. Well, it was a big mistake, because when I went there, I was very pro-America, having been trained well as an American, but I happened to meet Ecuadorian revolutionaries who frankly took pity on me and talked to me about the reality of the role of the United States, capitalism, exploitation. I saw it in the flesh, in person. And so that's it. I changed. My parents thought it would go away, but I never forgot what they taught me.
Boy, and then you've committed yourself to various causes. You were in Palestine helping the folks there resist the Israeli occupation.
We were trying to offer support. The communities where we were, their very existence is an act of resistance on a day-to-day basis. Their courage inspired us every day. You know, and they lived there day after day. Their children were afraid. They would get beaten. It was really horrible what the settlers do there.
Boy, so let's get up to date now. You are intimately involved with this deep green resistance movement that you're promoting and organizing. Do you want to give us a thumbnail of what that's about?
Deep Green Resistance is a new movement, only started about 5 months ago, and our goal is to dismantle industrial civilization while we still have time left. We believe, as all the scientists are saying every day, that we don't have much time left to stop fossil fuel production and use, and to stop all the other destruction that's happening. By every indicator, the planet is being destroyed, literally. And so we have a strategy that we think can work, an actual concrete strategy for how to stop them.
Well, before we go there, maybe, Lear, you can help me. A lot of folks want to fix our industrial civilization, believing that if we do this over here and this over there and that over there, we can turn this whole thing around and make it sustainable. What do you say to that?
Well, it's a complete contradiction. You have to understand, first of all, what civilization is, and then what industrial civilization is. And civilization is based on agriculture. And that means that you take a piece of land and you clear every living thing off it. And then you plant it to human use. So you destroy everything, and I mean down to the bacteria. So all those plants and animals, all those creatures, and they are responsible for the continuation of life on this planet. They're the ones who are doing that basic work of life, of producing and degrading. They're all destroyed. And in the process, you also destroy the topsoil. We owe our entire existence to 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. And this is what agriculture has done across the globe. There's nothing left. By 1950, we were out of topsoil. And so it's drawdown. It means people are living in concentrations that are too large for the local land base to support them. And that is literally what civilization means, the word civilization. It's life in cities. So you've got people who are, they're drawing down the resources. They've destroyed the land where they live. So of necessity, they must go out and take from the surrounding areas. So across the last 10,000 years, you see the same pattern over and over, where civilization arises and then it spreads out and it gets as far as it can, and it takes everything from the surrounding area. It's an absolutely voracious process. So the trees, the soil, the water, the animals, the metals, everything is taken and essentially left in some form of desert. You know, it's just profoundly degraded by the time this is done, and then it collapses. So you think of places like, you know, Iraq. We've at this point all seen pictures of Iraq because of this endless war, right? Well, that was a forest once upon a time. I mean, and the forest was so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. And nobody in their right mind would call that place the Fertile Crescent anymore. It hasn't been fertile for thousands of years. This is the end point of agriculture. So it's drawdown. This way of life is based on drawdown. And then you hit the year 1800, and what happens then is some human beings figure out how to use fossil fuel, so coal and oil and natural gas, and the whole thing goes on steroids. It's just a profound acceleration of the whole process. And just to give you an idea, if the average American had to get from human power what we are now getting from fossil fuel, we would each have 200 slaves. Okay, that's how much energy it uses to support the kind of lifestyle that we have. And clearly this is not a plan with the future. You know, the oil, we've hit peak oil. It's already happened, okay? We're on the downslope now.
Yep. We've had Richard Heinberg on as our guest a couple of times, and most of us here, I think, are very much convinced that you're right about that. There's no question we've peaked. But I wanted to ask, as you were talking agriculture, you didn't say industrial agriculture. Do you leave room for, like you say, you're a farmer, organic, small-scale farming, local permaculture? Do you view that as agriculture as well and exempt it, or view it as part of the bigger problem?
When I say agriculture, I mean very specifically annual monocrops.
Yeah.
So those row crops of, you know, corn and soy and wheat and whatever. That is, I mean, it sort of depends how you're going to define that, but that is one form of, you know, humans getting food. That would be agriculture. You've got a whole bunch of other methods. And the others depend on perennial polycultures. So those have at least a chance of being sustainable. The kinds of activities where you clear the land and you bare that soil and you push all the other living creatures off and then it's nothing but drawdown for 1,000 years, that's agriculture, okay? But you also have horticulture, you've got pastoralism and certainly hunter-gatherers. And when people talk about permaculture, it's really a form of horticulture. So it's not agriculture. And people are confused about this, I know, as these are not terms that they're used to using. But anything that's based on a perennial skeleton, you've got at least a chance that this is going to be okay. I mean, anything could be done poorly. I mean, right now there's pastoralists all over the world that are destroying their land base by overcrowding with, you know, goats or what have you. So clearly it can be done wrong. But done well, you know, these are ways that people integrate themselves into their land bases. They don't have to destroy them.
Yeah.
It's really all in the last 10,000 years that we've destroyed things. I mean, before that people lived in, you know, it may have taken time for them to figure out how as they moved on to new continents and moved into new areas, but, you know, we didn't leave the place trashed. And, you know, the European culture's only been on this continent for 200 years, and this continent is just trashed.
No doubt about it, and no doubt that we've been destroying the soil instead of building the soil. But there are farmers here who pride themselves in building soil and taking the permaculture design seriously and working to indeed make it sustainable agriculture, and they use the word agriculture. So I just didn't want to draw the line so big that we were attacking all our agriculture really for being the problem.
Right. Well, see, it's not how I would define agriculture. So,
gotcha.
Because
yeah.
If it's based on permaculture, then you've got those perennials in place, and
yeah.
That's what you need to protect the soil and to build it.
Yeah. No, excellent. Prema Dasi, could you weigh in a little bit on the fact that the idea of taking down our industrial civilization is a very scary thought, you know, and a lot of us have recognized that it may collapse on its own because it's so dependent on fossil fuels, and as we run out, we think that collapse is inevitable, and maybe the sooner the better. Do you share that perspective?
I do. I definitely think collapse would be the sooner the better. The thing that I have that terrifies me is when I hear people talk about letting it happen or kind of walking away from society and finding a place to live on the land that while it's collapsing. Because the problem is if we allow it to continue and collapse, then it'll take everything with it. So. And it's not going to collapse on its own quickly enough to stop it from taking everything with it. So,
because those folks with power are not going to voluntarily give up that power. We see that in the political system. Those with the wealth make sure the political system continues to support them.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so frightening to see how a lot of people who understand the dire situation we're in, but yet they're recommending solutions that are not matching the scale of the problem. I mean, if we just take a look at one fact, which is that given all the horrible reports about how climate change is accelerating, governments worldwide have done literally nothing, close to nothing. And so as things are getting worse, you can see governments, you know, doing the opposite of what's necessary. So we need solutions that match the scale of the problem.
Yeah, and Lear, can you expand on that? Because you stated that you don't believe that lifestyle or personal changes are effective methods for creating meaningful change, yet that's what I see most folks who are wanting sustainability badly are resorting to.
Yeah, and it's a dead end. I mean, right now scientists are debating whether over the next 50 years a quarter, a third, or half of all mammals will be extinct. And I just find it sort of stunning as well as repugnant that anybody would think that somehow walking away from the situation is the morally right thing to do.
I'm not sure these folks would see themselves as walking away. It's more they hope to persuade others by their good example.
Well, you know, example has never worked. And we can look back over the last 10,000 years of history. And literally, history is the story of the civilized invaders taking over the land of the indigenous people in the areas around them, taking whatever resources they wanted, enslaving the indigenous people, destroying their cultures, taking the trees, the water, the fish, the metals, whatever was there that they wanted, they took it. And over all that time, you know, the face-to-face example of sustainable, egalitarian, peaceful people has never once changed the culture, the invading civilized culture. That's never once in 10,000 years. It doesn't work. You know, as a method of political change, example does not work. They don't care. You know, they know what they're after. You know, and it's possible to use things like boycotts, I think, for very specific campaigns. I mean, you could get McDonald's to stop using, you know, eggs from hens and battery cages. I think that's a very winnable campaign. You know, you could target one company to change one policy. You're not going to bring down capitalism using a boycott. It would take millions and millions, billions of people, you know, to somehow withdraw from all consumption. And if you're going to organize people on that scale, you should just organize them to do something that's effective.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to collapse just because we stop participating. And our refusal to participate in these small little ways around the edges, it just, you know, I mean, I could have a cute little, perfect little permaculture backyard, whatever. The amphibian die-off is still going to come to my backyard. Global warming is still going to come to my backyard. The pollinator collapse around, you know, that's still going to come to my backyard. And when civilization wants what I have, whether it's my water, my trees, my soil, they're going to come and get it. So we've got to stop this. It's a monster, and we've got to stop it.
Well, and the monster is fed by us unwittingly. I mean, I think many people aren't seeing themselves as co-conspirators to what you're defining as this evil force, essentially, that must be stopped. We all tie into it with our consumerism, do we not? We all tie into it with the work that we do for corporations that are part of this exploitation of nature.
Yeah, but I think it's a dead end to blame us each as individuals because it's not our fault. I mean, we were born into this system, and the solution isn't to then live a pure life. As you know, I mean, I have this quote that a lot of people have, you know, used, which is the task of an activist is not to navigate or negotiate around systems of power with as much personal integrity as possible. It's to bring down those systems. And there aren't any personal solutions to social political problems. They require social movements. They require political movements that have the strength and the will and the strategy to actually, you know, bring down those systems. And that's what we're lacking right now is a serious resistance movement to industrialization, to the sort of capitalist pyramid scheme, and ultimately to civilization itself.
Well, you're right. And most of us, our whole lives have been conditioned to work within that capitalist system, have acquired what we believe is wealth and power and prestige, and we all don't really want to lose that. Nobody wants to even lose their financial assets, let alone feel like all of these institutions like our schools and hospitals and will collapse on us. That's a scary thought to most folks.
Could I jump in here?
Of course, of course.
I just wanted to add, just very concretely, because I knew when I heard this, it really changed my life. And I think it's this very well-hidden secret that's just not out there. That, for example, if every American took every single action suggested by Al Gore in the movie An Inconvenient Truth, that it would only reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 21%. And so it's not an accident that what is being promoted as a solution are personal solutions and blaming individuals for their consumption. I mean, consumption is a problem, but what that does is it lets the corporations and capitalism and the government and the people, the 1% of people who are literally living off of the whole planet, off the hook. And I think that this, we have to find a way to break through with this information that, you know, the Department of Defense of the United States of America is the largest user of oil on the planet. So we could all stop using our cars and all of that, and it wouldn't make a dent in the consumption that's done by industry in terms of water and oil and everything else.
You're right. Where's the mainstream environmental movement in terms of confronting these systems of power and holding individuals, industries, and institutions accountable?
Well, there are some very committed people at the grassroots level who are involved in a lot of, you know, mainstream movements, and they are fighting like hell to save places and creatures that they love. But most of the mainstream organizations are really just big corporations in themselves, and they exist to fundraise for themselves. And pretty much they function like every other corporation. They're certainly not going to question capitalism. They're not even leftist. I mean, for me, the moment when you become a leftist is when you're willing to question capitalism. And you can get more and more radical the further out you go, but that's the real dividing line. So they're centrist. You know, they're not even leftist organizations, much less being anti-industrial. And there's a lot of interlocking boards of directors. So, you know, just to give you one example, the guy who was in charge of the National Wildlife Federation, Jay Hare, he left office at the NWF, and he went on to work for Plum Creek to do public relations work for Plum Creek. And if you don't know who they are, they're probably the worst timber company that's ever existed, just completely horrendous. So you see this kind of overlap between, you know, the boards of directors and the CEOs of the big eco, the big green organizations, with industry. So they're completely hand in glove. So of course they're not going to question capitalism. They're not going to, you know, push their members to undertake anything more radical than changing light bulbs. And we need to completely change the economic system. You know, light bulbs aren't going to cut it.
Yep.
So that's, you know, that's part of the problem. And I think people join with all the best intentions. You know, anybody who's half awake has got to feel the desperation of what's happening on this planet. But their impulses get completely rerouted toward that kind of personal lifestyle or consumption stuff that just is not going to make a dent in this system.
We are talking not only resilience, which we do a lot on this program, but we're talking resistance today with two preeminent leaders in that movement. One is Premadasi Amada, and the other is Lierre Keith. That's L-I-E-R-R-E Keith. Lierre, you have a website. If folks want to learn more about you, they can go to LierreKeith.com.
Correct, and I always say that's easy as long as you know how to spell my name.
L-I-E-R-R-E.
And that's it.
Keith, the normal spelling. And is there another website, Premadasi, that you would want to promote for your organization?
Yes, we have a website for Deep Green Resistance, and the address is deepgreenresistance.org.
That's great. So in the first half hour here, we've been sort of laying the groundwork. You folks in this organization, in this movement, talk about an above-ground movement, below-ground movement. Do you want to tell us more about that strategy?
Well, I would say we have two broad goals for this movement, and the first is to deprive the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and to deprive the powerful of their power to destroy the planet. And the second goal, you know, sort of how we would do that is we need to support and rebuild local autonomous communities, and as part of that, absolutely repair the land, repair the planet, repair all the things that have been destroyed. So that's sort of our grand strategy. So we think that this could be done using sort of a two-pronged approach. And the first is that we need a very strong above-ground movement that would use, for the frontline activists, they would mostly use nonviolent civil disobedience. But in a way that's not symbolic, because right now I feel like it's a very profound tactic that has been used very successfully by lots of different movements throughout history. But right now in the United States, it's mostly being used symbolically. So they have one-day protests that don't actually obstruct anything.
Right.
And that's, you know, you're sort of taking the teeth out of it because, you know, you can do a lot with civil disobedience, but you have to use it correctly. And it's not being used in a way that's strategic at all. So we're trying to build toward that. And behind the scenes with, you know, sort of doing the background work is in some ways the most important stuff. And that would be, you know, direct democracy. So, you know, reclaiming, tearing down the institutions that aren't working and rebuilding, reclaiming the ones that might work better. So we need direct democracy, especially on a local level. We need a brand new constitution. I think that this country is way too big anyway. I mean, it's eventually going to fall into smaller units of, you know, that are bioregional. But a country this big is just never going to last. So I like a better model that would be more like the Swiss model or the Swedish model. These are, I think, much more interesting constitutions to look at in terms of how their federal governments operate, because power is invested in the local level. And then they're confederated across larger areas that make the federal government. That was specifically written out of the U.S. Constitution because there were people calling for it at the time that it was written. And they lost. And these were the people who were experimenting with direct democracy on that local level. And who won was the capitalists, the merchant class. They were some of the richest men in America, and they wrote a constitution that would let them gut this continent and turn it into private wealth. And almost nobody is saying that out loud, but as long as the U.S. Constitution stands, this planet's not going to live. And I believe that very strongly. So anyway, we need that kind of, you know, local, lively, vibrant participation, and the people who do that have got to have the power to control the material conditions of their lives, because right now we don't. So we need to take that power back from the people who have taken it from us. And all of everything's wrapped up in that, that, you know, you need to have local food, you need to have, you know, control of your local economy. We don't have that right now. Corporate America controls everything. And, of course, that all has to be nestled within, you know, this care and concern for the land that's been so destroyed. So all of that stuff needs to happen. And this is where I want the permaculture people to get involved. The transition towners could play a role. And what I feel like those people are missing right now is the concept of resistance, that they don't have to do it themselves, but we need to understand that it will be very necessary. Well, so I want support for the frontline resistors, for the above ground.
Well, yeah, let me just tell you a little bit about West Marin as I see it. You know, the permaculture design ethic is certainly here. Many people subscribing to it and wanting to carry it forward. It helped be a foundation for transition towns. We've adopted that spirit here in terms of visioning a future that is post-carbon and is very local and is resilient in terms of getting the local supplies. We haven't done the resistance part, except to some degree. I want to honor Bing Gong, unfortunately not here today, but he did go to Washington, D.C. and was part of the protest on the XL pipeline to carry the Alberta tar sands bitumen down to the Gulf Coast. So there's a start here of some folks taking some resistance, and then some other resistance, I guess, in a very minor way right now, is sort of related to the Occupy movement, and there's a small Occupy Point Reyes that is wanting the Wells Fargo Bank to be replaced by a smaller local banking institution. So in small ways, we're moving in that direction, but you can recommend to us kind of some stronger strategies and how we might really step that up.
I wanted to add something about making so we have, as Leah mentioned, we have two parts to our strategy. We have an above-ground part of the strategy and an underground part of the strategy. And so when we talk about resistance, as Leah mentioned, for the above-ground, for us, resistance would mean serious, sustained, direct action at sites of industry, as opposed to symbolic action. So we would literally use our bodies to stop oil production, to stop coal plants, and to do it in a sustained way, not one-day blockades, but to stay for weeks and months and years if necessary. And so that's what we mean by above-ground resistance. But when we talk about underground resistance, and So throughout history, many resistance movements have included an underground that actually dismantles the strategic infrastructure of power. And they've done that because it's an effective strategy. It works. So that's, that kind of organization and training is something that almost no one is talking about, and that we are using our media and education to try to get out the understanding that without an underground that does that type of resistance, we simply won't be successful in saving the planet while there's still time.
Boy, I agree with the urgency. Let me also point out that there is a nucleus here of folks quite ready to rebel against what corporations are bringing. Our electric utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, has been installing smart meters throughout the state. And here there were even a couple of brave women who stood in the street and blocked the truck that came to install them right on one of our major thoroughfares, and were ready to be arrested. So we know that there are people here who believe deeply in making a stand here for the planet, for our future. And so that's why I think it's exciting to have you folks on the radio. And the more you can sort of give us ideas and help us in that way, I think we'd be very grateful.
Well, I have two examples from history, very recent history, that I like to talk about and that we mention in the book. And the first is last year in France, there was a big labor strike because there's all those quote-unquote austerity measures, which is just, you know, dismantling the social safety net that people fought for, you know, with their lives. And, you know, who's getting the money? It's the same here. It's the bankers who are getting all the money, the financiers. So there was a huge strike in France, a labor strike. And they thought very strategically, the way that people who are serious should be thinking. So using nonviolent civil disobedience, using human blockades, they went right to the source, and they blockaded all the oil depots and all the oil refineries. And that meant that within 3 weeks, the entire economy of France was just grinding to a halt because there was no oil. And there were 20 tankers that were stranded in the Mediterranean that couldn't come into dock. So the French government opened the emergency stores of oil, and then the protesters escalated again, and they blockaded those oil depots as well. Eventually, the strike was broken off, but you can see how successful it could be. And what it means, though, is that you need millions of people to do it. You know, a huge proportion of the French population had to turn out to do this, and they had to mean it. And the real question is, do we have the numbers?
Well, right now, the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy in every town, has tapped into that that anger and readiness for people to get out in the streets around the financial issues. I don't know that it's brought in the environmental issues to save the planet as much as save my pocketbook. But isn't that the kind of movement you hope for?
Yes, and it's an interesting collection of people. And, you know, in any kind of broad-based call, you're going to have more liberal and then a continuum over to more radical. And you're right, some of these people are mad because their middle-class entitlements have disappeared. You know, that middle-class lifestyle is built on, you know, the death of the planet and, you know, vast quantities of fossil fuels. So it is over, and it's over permanently. And
by that you mean Social Security and Medicare are part of that picture that you're painting, right?
Well, to me, that's just, you know, basic human care and compassion for our own. I wouldn't call taking care of old people and taking care of sick people, you know, that has nothing to do with fossil fuel consumption.
Okay, all right.
That's just what people have always done for each other because we're social beings, and you know, in our best behavior, we care about each other, and that should just be basic to any society that, you know, dares to call itself such, should be taking care of the vulnerable. But you know, what's going on with the Occupy movement is interesting to me because they're not really sit-ins yet. They're not really occupying much. They're going to need to escalate if, in fact, they intend to do something. And that means that they're going to have to go into the stock exchange, into the banks, or into the government offices and actually occupy them. Right now, they're more of a witness movement. They're standing on the side saying, we're watching you. They're not actually disrupting the centers of finance, not yet.
More like the students of Berkeley did in the 60s, right? Occupy the administration building.
Yeah, and yes, exactly. They need to actually disrupt that business from happening. And so that would be my advice to them. And, you know, the question is, are the more radical voices going to win out, because a lot of the voices there are, you know, they're very liberal and they just want to be middle class again. But you've got people who are very willing. I've heard a number of interviews where people are saying capitalism is a problem, you know, where it's destroying the planet. It's always a pyramid scheme. You know, it depends on there being an impoverished underclass. You know, they're very clear about naming capitalism. So I want those voices to win out in this movement, and I want the other people to get more radicalized and be willing to name more than just, you know, corporate greed. Well, who's not against greed? You know, greed is not the problem. Corporations are set up to be sociopathic institutions. That's the point of a corporation, is limited liability, right? The point is that they make profit for their stockholders. They're not in the business of providing food. That's not what they're there for. So they need to question, you know, a lot deeper, and I'm really hoping that the radical voices can win, you know, as this movement sort of develops. But I think it's really wonderful to see that people are at least angry, finally, about something. And yes, so we need that kind of occupation, and they need to actually occupy, not just stand up with us.
Good point. Prima Dasi, do you have anything to say to the movement?
Well, actually, since I'm the organizer, I wanted to announce, and this is the first time we're announcing on the radio today, that we issued a statement, open letter to the Occupy movement. You know, I love the Occupy movement. I think it's a beautiful thing. And I really want to see all that energy and all that love that's out there, all those people making those commitments. I'm hoping that can, some of that energy can go towards occupying, places where we can actually stop the 1%, right? Because we don't want to just, tell the 1%, you know, you're horrible and this is wrong. We want to actually stop them. And the way to stop them is to occupy the places where they make their money. And I've heard a lot of talk about this distinction between Occupy going after Wall Street and the financial movement versus focusing on the environment. And to me, it's a false distinction, because I know that the people who run the world and who are living off of all of us make their money by exploiting the environment and by taking away land from indigenous people. These are not separate issues at all. They're all one issue. And so if we want to stop the 1%, we have to go to their factories. We have to go to the pipelines. We have to go to the ports where trade happens, and we have to go to the stock exchanges inside. And all those things have to be occupied. And so our statement, you know, suggests some things, and hopefully it can begin a conversation about kind of switching to more direct targets for occupying. So we're calling it Occupy the Machine.
How long is your statement? Is it something you could read over the air here without taking too much time?
No, it's a long statement. It's about 4 pages.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And how will we be able to find that? Will it be on YouTube or something like that?
Well, it's now on the Deep Green Resistance website.
Oh, perfect.
If you go to deepgreenresistance.org, it's the first post there.
Okay.
And it's being put out on Twitter and Facebook all over the place now, and we want people to spread it and comment and give feedback. I mean, I see such great potential in people coming out finally and in a major way and saying, well, we're not going to demonstrate for one day. We're not going to blockade for one day. We're going to stay here. And we're not going to go anywhere until it's done. And that's what I support.
Has Keith Olbermann called you yet?
No.
Well, we need that.
We do need that. It would be so great to get that kind of national exposure.
Well, I guess we need to make a big splash in the news first, right?
Yeah, probably. So
yeah.
The first time we actually blockade an oil refinery, hopefully the press will be there.
Yeah, and at the November 13th event in Berkeley, where folks can go to earthatrisk.net to learn the details. Will that have opportunity for people to actually strategize actions?
No, there's not going to be time for breakout sessions of that sort, though certainly Prima Dasi and others will be there with a table, and they can talk to people who want to get signed up and start to talk, you know, on more of a nuts and bolts kind of level about what's going to happen next.
So there also will be an event November 18th where a DGR organizer named Dylan Thompson, who's actually speaking, doing a deeper resistance speaking tour, he's going to have an event there. Unfortunately, I don't have the details with me right now, but if you go to our website, it'll be there soon. And then at that event, for sure, there'll be time for questions and answers and strategizing and for people to sign up, because what we want is for people to sign up with deeper resistance action groups. So to the, there's action groups all over the country and in different parts of the world. This is an international movement. And the more groups that form that have this analysis of what's necessary to save us in time, the closer we can get to actually shifting our movements to be more effective. I think there's a good basis out there for people. People are getting tired of the way things are, and they're starting to see that they have the power to change things. But there needs to be people calling for people to do more, to take sacrifices, to take risks, and there's not a lot of that happening.
Boy, you're right. And I was thinking, it's not Keith Olbermann, it's Amy Goodman we got to go to first, right? But will you send her your document?
Sure, we're sending it to everyone. Please,
absolutely.
Send it out.
And Lierre, you talk about liberal and progressive, and then you talk about radical resistor. A lot of folks here view they're very progressive, very liberal. They want to make the rich pay their fair share. But they wouldn't see themselves in this radical resistor category. Can you define those terms a little more and what says you've crossed over?
In terms of just classic political philosophy, there's a few major differences between liberals and radicals. And the first one is that liberals understand society as being made up of individuals. So the individual is that basic social unit. And on the radical side, and this is really the gift of Karl Marx, and he was the one who really laid this down, society is made up of groups of people. It's not made up of individuals. And so there's groups, in his original version it was economic class, but really any group or caste, so it could be, a racial group or an economic class or, what have you. But it's groups of people, and some groups have power over other groups, and that's really the point. So you've got the rich over the poor, and you've got white people over people of color, and you've got men with power over women. So this social oppression is always a matter of groups. So one group has power and the other group is dispossessed. So that's the first main difference. And the second is that liberalism is what's called idealist. So for liberals, society is something that happens more in the mind than anywhere else. It's made up of ideas. And so the biggest way to change things is to change people's minds. And so they think that education is the main way that social change happens. Now, over on the radical side, it's different. They don't think that society is made up of ideas. Society is actually made up of material institutions. And social change ultimately happens because those material institutions are taken apart. And the people who are dispossessed either force change upon them or they take them down completely and build new institutions. So you can see that there'd be a conflict here. And oftentimes, conflicts in groups happen because some people are more liberal and some are more radical. And it's a really basic set of understandings about what is social reality and how social change happens. Sometimes if you can just remember, oh, right, that's a liberal perspective, you'll understand more where somebody's coming from. But ultimately, the radicals don't think that social change, it doesn't happen by some kind of moral persuasion. It doesn't happen by spiritual epiphany. It doesn't happen by personal change. It happens. And it's not that education's not important. Education's very important for radicals. But the goal is not simply to change minds. The goal is actually to build a movement that's strong enough that they can take on the institutions of power and redistribute power across society.
In order to recruit folks for this radical movement, don't we look at the folks that are already in the sort of the soft resistance side who are recognizing that the planet is being raped, that educating women is critical throughout the world to get population under control? And isn't there a first set of folks to appeal to join this movement? Or do you think that really you need to cast your net wider than folks who are currently activists as progressives and liberals?
I think it depends on who the person is who's doing the casting of the net. Because for me, I feel like I'm best at reaching people who have very radical impulses, perhaps don't have the language to explain what they see around them. But I've always been somebody who was very radical, and so those are the people that I can talk to. I feel like we're made of the same stuff, and we speak each other's you know, we're speaking in the same tongue. And what I can bring is just some clarity to the situation and perhaps some strategies that nobody else is suggesting. Now, that's me. For somebody else, you know, if they come from maybe a conservative religious background and, you know, they've gone through a transformation, embraced more radical ideas, you know, they can talk to other people who come from that same background and sort of, because they know what that mindset is like. I can't really get inside that mindset. I don't really know how to speak to those people. So we need it all. We need, you know, every, whatever it is that your gift is, you know, we need to use it in service of this planet and hopefully of this resistance movement. So I wouldn't close off any of these possibilities. There are people who start way conservative and end up being, you know, incredible assets to radical movements. And likewise, there are people like me who, you know, started out pretty radical and, you know, then get burned out and stop. So those are some of the people I want to reach is more, you know, this is true. In your heart of hearts, you still remember. So why is it that you stopped? And I know some of the reasons that people stopped. So I can speak to that, you know, in a way that's more effective.
I personally was maybe 5 years ago still defending corporations. I was the last one in our family to hold that view. And then Al Gore and Michael Pollan and Heinberg and others finally turned me around. And so then I've got to a point now where I already turn off most of my family and friends by being as progressive as I am. To turn even more radical makes it feel like I'm going to be totally ostracized and alone. I need to find that support group of folks who will go with me.
You know. And I don't think you're alone in that. That's something that I've heard for years from people. If I take one more step and I become as radical as you are, I will have no friends. And this is why we talk about a culture of resistance, that no resistance movement can survive without a supporting culture around it. And that just includes basic friendship. I mean, that's one of the things that a culture of resistance provides, is that kind of emotional support for the people who are going to go ahead and be public, who are going to take scary actions, who are going to do things that are threatening. They're all going to need a lot of support. And it's really important for this concept of a culture of resistance. We're really going to need that.
Well, we're getting to that place in the hour. I need to end the program and say goodbye to both of you. I want to give you one last chance for a comment. So Premadasi, Amada, deepgreenresistance.org. Do you want to leave us with any final words?
Yeah, I guess I just want to share that I, as a longtime activist, when I found out about Deep Green Resistance and I read the book, I felt like I had come home. And I feel like if there are people out there who are tired of ineffective activism, you know, who are heartbroken, who are feeling like there's no way to stop this thing, that I encourage them to check out the strategy, because I think that they might find inspiration the way I did. And I hope that more and more people see that we can stop this machine, literally, if we all get together and do it.
Excellent. I wish you great success. And Lyra Keith, any last comments for our listeners?
We need warriors who will put themselves between what is left of this planet and fossil fuel. And you must love something or you wouldn't be listening to this show. Well, love is a verb. So we've got to let that love call us to action.
Boy, excellent. I'm you ladies give me hope. This is what I need to keep my energy up and focus up. And I'm willing to be a part of a Marin County Deep Green Resistance. I'd love to help organize such a group.
Oh, that's great.
Yay!
And I know Bing is of similar heart, and we're wishing his speedy recovery so he can get back active in our community as he is. And I hope our listeners will also go to earthatrisk.net to check out that event in Berkeley on the 13th, where we might congregate and you know, find each other. So thank you, ladies, so much.
And also just to add, deepgreenresistance.org.
Fabulous. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.